Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Noach. It means rest. It's Genesis chapter 6 from verse 9 to Genesis 11 verse 32. The Haftarah is Isaiah 54 verses 1 to 17 and Isaiah 55 verses 1 to 5. And the Brit Hadashah is Matthew chapter 24 verses 36 to 46. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, Creator of all things. We thank you for your Torah, for your word. We thank you for all that you do just to keep this world together and how you are attempting to make us your people. I pray that you would bless us as we keep this Sabbath and open our ears and our hearts and minds to only what you would have us to hear. If anything comes from my flesh, I pray that it would just fall to the ground and die, and that only your words, only your truth would flourish. I ask in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Okay, let's start back with Genesis 5:28. I know the Torah portion starts at Genesis 6:9, but let's go backward for a minute. Lamech lived 182 years and begat a son, and he called his name Noah, saying, "This same shall comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." One of the themes of the Noah Torah portion, or the Noah account, is that of recreation. Now, the word for comfort right there in verse 29 is not the same verse that we use for ruach, but it does have to do with breath. And that word is Strong's 5162. It is nacham. And it means to breathe strongly, or to sigh, or to console. It even means to avenge oneself, to comfort oneself, and to repent. That's the whole story right there in a nutshell in Noah's name. Now, we know that the Lord regretted his decision in making Adam, or mankind. And so the world at this point in this Torah portion is desperately in need of a savior figure, and Noah was it. Genesis 6:9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Now, let's take a look at that word perfect, because perfection in the scripture is not what we think it is today. That word is Strong's 8549. The Hebrew word is tamim. It means entire, or it literally is complete. It comes from the word tamam to mean complete, and tamim also is complete, but it is morally complete, not as in it something that is finished, but morally complete. And another word for it is whole. Now, so what this has to do with is a person's integrity. The earth apparently was lacking in integrity. No one except Noah had integrity. Perfection in the Lord's honor and shame context in which the Bible was written does not mean that you never mess up, that you never commit a sin. But it does mean that you have the integrity to make a repair when you have broken a relationship or broken some part of the Torah when you have sinned or committed a crime against the Lord's law. It's the reparation, the restitution. You know, these things complete the circle that has been broken, and they make that circle whole again. You know, when you break the plate, it's, you know, in a half, right? But when you get the super glue out and you put those two halves together, now you've made it whole. That's what perfection is, that you make it right. And so Noah's destiny, because of his integrity, because he walked in that wholeness, always being mindful of how his actions were affecting other people, his destiny then was to renew Adam, or to renew mankind. In other words, he was to fill the earth with people that it would be possible for the Lord to redeem. You see, because at that time, because of the total corruption and because of the mixture of the fallen ones with the daughters of humans, there was nothing for the Lord to redeem. The Lord cannot redeem mankind when it's mixed with the fallen ones, because those fallen ones are not redeemable. And so they were trying to mess up the line of Messiah that had been prophesied in our last Torah portion by mixing in the DNA of the fallen ones with the DNA of human beings, thus creating a race of human beings that were just like themselves, which was that they were not redeemable. There's no redemption plan for those angelic beings who decided to rebel against the Lord. That's why they have to be destroyed. And he made, though, a redemption plan for mankind, you see. But if you mix mankind in with the fallen ones, then mankind becomes unredeemable. And so the Lord has first to renew his own commitment to mankind, and then he has to find a man that is whole or perfect, you know, within the honor and shame context that he, this man will work with a situation and restore things, and so to speak, you know. And so the Lord has to find that kind of a man, and he found that in Noah. Now in Genesis 6:10 it says, Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japheth, though, is the oldest son, but he is considered to be the one with the least wisdom. Ham is the second son, but he is the most unrighteous, and he's even perverted, as we're going to see later on in this account. His grandson, Ham's grandson, is Nimrod, and we know what Nimrod is. So there you have the line that is perverted. That's the line of Ham. Shem is the youngest, but he was the most righteous. Thus, he became the one that the right of the firstborn was bestowed upon. He was given the responsibility for the rest of the family. And in fact, all Hebrews, the Edomites, and the Ishmaelites are all descended from Shem. And we're going to see later on as we go through Genesis that the family splits and that there becomes, you know, war between the members of the line of Shem. But I want to tell you why I say that Japheth or Japheth is the oldest son and Shem is the youngest. Here is a quote from John Salehammer, who wrote the Pentateuch as narrative in 1992. In his comment, he says, Here's the author's here the author's aim is to show that God's promise concerning the seed of the woman cannot be thwarted by the confusion and scattering of the nations of Babylon. Though the seed of Noah were scattered at Babylon, God had preserved a line of 10 great men from Noah to the chosen seed of Abraham. Out of the ruins of the two great cities, the city of Cain and the city of Babylon, God has preserved his promised seed. By beginning the list of names over again with Shem, the author shows his intention to bypass the other line that had been traced to Shem in the previous chapter. What he's talking about here is how the line was taken from, you know, Japheth being the oldest to now Shem is listed in first place. And the reason for that is because in chapter 10, we read the line of the sons of Noah in order. And the order is this: Japheth came first, and then we read about Ham's descendants, and then we read about Shem's descendants. In chapter 10, we read about the order in which those sons were actually born. And we see here with this reversal, this turning upside down, the firstborns, the physical firstborn is replaced by the spiritual firstborn. We see this as a pattern that the Lord started with Seth, who was the son of Adam and Eve. He was not their first son, but he was the son that would carry on the Messiah. Thus, he came to be the one that would later on be the ancestor of Lamech, and Lamech was Noah's son. And so he carries the line of the Messiah through the spiritual firstborn. Why is that? Because you have to be born again in the spirit. This is why when Yeshua said to Nicodemus, what do you mean? You got to get back in your mother's womb? What are you talking about, Nicodemus? Don't you understand the spiritual principle of being born again? You're born of the Spirit. And it starts here in the beginning, this understanding about being the spiritual birth, you see, is the most important birth, not the physical birth. And so now let's go to verse 12. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And in the International Standard Version, it said, God looked at the earth, observing how corrupt its population had become, because the entire human race had corrupted itself. So, in other words, every person except Noah was corrupt. And I know that that probably raises questions about Noah's wife and his sons and his daughters-in-law. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But in verse 6:13, it says, And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. That word there, violence, is Hamas. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. The earth is the witness. And he's going to make the earth a witness here in a little bit, but the earth destroys them. So notice that the Lord never intended to destroy Noah. Noah was never in the Lord's sights. And this is also an example here of, you know, the Lord saving the family. One of the things that we've been promised is that the Lord will save our families. He will bring them to the point where they have to make a decision. In our day, it's going to be him bringing them into the wilderness where they will make their decision. Unfortunately, we don't have a choice as to whether our sons and daughters will rebel against the Lord at that point and be kicked out. But we do know that He will bring them with us in the wilderness like He did with Noah's family in the ark. And so we see that pattern here. Now, then in this chapter we get a description of the ark, and in verse 17, the Lord says that He's going to destroy all flesh, but that in verse 18, He's going to establish His covenant with Noah, and that he should come into the ark with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. So we're starting to see this pattern of Him saving our families. Now, the other thing that we want to take note of here is that the Lord put two of every unclean animal and or being or entity into the ark, except for the clean animals that He put in by sevens. So two of everything that's unclean, but seven of everything that's clean. Why is that? Well, one of the reasons is because now we're starting to get the repeat of the creation story that we had in Bereshit. There are 7 days, and here we are going to see that in this Torah portion, we're going to repeat that number 7 many times. But we're going to start with the 7 clean animals. So we're going to be constantly reminded about the 7 because the Lord intended for the earth to be cleansed and for His people to once again celebrate the 7th, the Sabbath, you see. And so in Genesis 7:12, it says that rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So they're in the ark, it rained 40 days and 40 nights. And what is the number 40? Well, it indicates a time of testing. In ancient times, people were thrown into the water to be tested as to whether or not they would drown. If you drowned, you were deemed to be guilty of the crime that was alleged against you. But if you survived, you were deemed to be innocent. And so in this account, only Noah and his family were deemed innocent because they were the only people to survive this water judgment test. And now in Genesis 7:20, in the International Standard Version, it's easier to see what's going on here. It says, the flood waters rose 22.5 feet above the mountains. That number 22 is not without significance here. 22 is the amount of numbers in the, or the amount of letters, the number, how many letters there is in the Hebrew language. So, because in the beginning it was the Word, which contains the Hebrew language, it was the language that created the earth, and so it here is the language that will destroy the earth and renew the earth. The same 22 letters in the Hebrew language. And in verse 24, it says, the flood waters surged over the earth for 150 days. Now, if you take a 30-day month, you find out that that's roughly 5 months of water on the earth, right? The great tribulation at the end, we'll see 5 months of darkness. The waters of the flood are a type of that darkness, that same thing which will be at the end, but it's also that which was at the beginning in Bereshit. Now, the ark with the people in it is the same thing as the ruach, which hovered or vibrated there above the water. You know, the rocking back and forth of the ark. That's the same thing as when the ruach was upon the face of the deep. And it's the same thing that's happening this time as was happening in the beginning. You see, in the beginning, when the Ruach was on the face of the deep, all things were still in a state of potentiality. And here in the Ark, we see all things are in a state of potentiality. And in Genesis 8:6, it says, "And it came to pass at the end of 40 days, again, that time of testing, that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made, and he sent forth a raven which went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth." That word for raven is Strong's 6158. It is Oreb. Now, what does that sound like? It sounds like Erev, like evening, right? And so what the Lord is telling us here, and in fact, this word Oreb is from the word Arab or Erev, as we say it. What the Lord is telling us here is that the evening comes first. You see how he is repeating himself so that we don't get confused and decide that, you know, the day starts actually at midnight or the day starts at 6 a.m. No, he wants us to understand about the raven, the Oreb, being like the Erev, which is the evening, and that the days start in the evening, and the evening and the morning are the first day and the second day and so forth. And then the Lord sends out the dove. Doves are white. It's an indication of the light. You see, here's another recreation principle happening. The raven goes out first, the Erev, the evening and the darkness, and then the dove, which is light for the day. So we're seeing the same principles being given here the second time in creation. This is the renewal of the creation. And in Genesis 8:9 it says, "But the dove found no rest for the sole of her foot, and she returned to him into the ark, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Then he put forth his hand and took her and pulled her into him into the ark, and he stayed yet another 7 days. And again he sent forth the dove out of the ark, and the dove came into him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. So Noah knew that the waters were abated from the earth." So again we see the symbolism of this being a re-creation. You know, in the beginning, the dove, or the Ruach, found not a resting place on the earth because of the corruption of mankind. So there has to be a second attempt now, and that's with Noah. The Ruach could not inhabit and make temples and be in the hearts of people because they very quickly corrupted themselves. And so now we're having this dove, the Ruach, once again trying to find a resting place for her foot, and she does find it in the second attempt. This is again associated with the 7 days. You know, in verse 10 it says, "And Noah stayed another 7 days." Again, that is an allusion to the celebration of the days of creation with the seventh day as the Sabbath. And in verse 18 it says, "And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry." Now, there's in here a prophecy of future cleansing. This 601st year is actually in the seventh period. The first period is 0 to 100. The second period is 101 to 200. The third period is 201 to 300. And so forth until you get down to the seventh period, which is 601 and forward, you see. And so here we have, using the years as 100 years, it's actually can be viewed prophetically as a 1,000-year period as well. In the Hebrew mind, we don't get stuck with it has to be 100, it can't be 1,000, because we understand that all of these things are symbolic of each other. And so we're seeing in this passage here, verse 13, that there's a prophecy here. Not only did this happen in the 601st year, or in the first year of the millennium, okay, in the future millennium, we see that there is a cleansing that has happened. And so it's lending itself to prophecy there. And then in verse 14, it says, "And in the second month, on the 7th and 20th day of the month, was the earth dried." That is the 27th day of the month. Now, the number 27 is significant in the history of the Hebrews, and I've done a little short look at that, and I've not done a big study of it, but a short look at it. And, you know, some very significant things happened in the 27th year, or in the 27th day of a month, or whatever. But I want to draw your attention to the next time that we see the number 27, and that is when Sarah died, when she is 127 years old. And there are a number of other scriptures, you can do the search yourself, where the number 27 is part of celebrating, or the number 27 is part of a prophecy of destruction. It's kind of a fascinating study. Anyway, in Genesis 8:20, it says that Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the Lord. On the altar to the Lord. The first time around, when Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden, we see that the Lord made skins, animal skins, for them. What he was really doing there, the Lord is not wasteful. You know, he didn't just kill animals and skin them and give them to Adam and Eve. No, he was doing a sacrifice. We can extrapolate and understand that because Cain and Abel knew about sacrifices. They had to have learned it from Adam and Eve, who would have learned it from the Lord. And so when the Lord cast them out of the garden, they had a sacrifice done for them by the Lord. And so we see again the parallel here between this renewal creation, or this renewed creation, to the original creation. And so we're continuing in that same vein in Genesis 9:1, when the Lord blesses Noah and his sons and tells them to be fruitful and multiply, just like he did to Adam and Eve. So you see, this whole thing is about renewal, about restoration, about having a second chance. It's about the Lord's mercy. For people to believe that grace and mercy were only bestowed on mankind in the New Testament is really terribly, to terribly misunderstand the scriptures. Because this whole account of Noah has to do with the grace and mercy that the Lord extends to mankind, and that he extends even to all of his creation. that he didn't just destroy it and do away with it. And so in verse 9, or in chapter 9, verse 3, it says, here we're going to learn some little different things, because in the garden, the Lord said, I'm going to give you every green herb, and all the animals and everybody, they'll eat all the green herbs. Okay, but here he says, I'm going to give you every moving thing that lives to be meat for you, to be food for you. As the green herb, you know, you can eat the green herb, but you can eat the animals too. And why would he do that? Well, in verse 2, he says, the animals are going to have fear of you, and dread of you shall be upon every beast on the earth, and every fowl of the air, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. This is to go even further than what he told Adam and Eve, that, you know, you're to dominate and have dominion over the animals, but now they're delivered into man's hand, and they become food for him. And yes, the Lord did say all of these things, anything that moves that you want to eat, you can eat it. Why did he do that? Because we say, no, you need to be following this kosher diet list that the Lord gives us in the Torah. Well, when the Lord separates out a people for himself, he is going to make a distinction between them and everyone else on the earth by doing several things. First of all, they're going to have a special day of worship, which we know is the Sabbath. But one of the other things that he's going to do is he's going to have a dietary list, because he's not going to have his people putting unclean things in their body, because it makes them unable to come before him to worship. But until that time, until, you know, every Gentile on the earth can just eat whatever they want. It's when you decide that you want to be a peculiar people and to be made distinct from all other people and to be elevated above the Gentiles in the Lord's eyes and be in covenant with him, that's when the dietary laws come into play. And in verse 5, he says, and surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, and at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Now, we're getting something in this second re-creation that we didn't get the first time around. The first time, the only law that we had reported to us, even though the Torah was with us, and I believe Adam understood and knew the Torah, or he was supposed to anyway, we only had that one law, which had to do with don't eat that fruit over there. But now he's going to talk about murder. If a beast kills a person, it's considered murder. That's why in the Torah, when your ox gores someone, you die along with your ox. If you knew that that ox had that kind of disposition and you didn't kill the ox, now that ox becomes a method of murder for you. So the Lord is very concerned with murder, because the very first thing that happened out of the gate was Cain murdering Abel, you see. So now we're going to start to get our, he's giving us our laws, okay? And in verse 8, he says, and God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you. And what this has to do when it says with your seed after you, well, it means that your ancestors and mine went into covenant with the Lord, and you don't get a vote. It applies to you, whether you like it or not, it applies to you, and you can rebel against it all day long and all night, but it's not going to do you any good because it was established with your ancestors and with the seed that came after. You're the seed that came after. I'm the seed that came after. So these covenants get established with all of the descendants, with all of the progeny, and we don't get to decide, whether or not we agree with that. We just get to know that that covenant has been established. And in verse 10 it says, "And every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, and of every beast on the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark, and to every beast of the earth." Oh, did you know that this covenant was with Noah and his sons, and with all of the progeny on the earth that came after him, and with every living creature that is on the earth? Well, yeah, it did. And what is that covenant? Well, that is the promise that the Lord will never destroy the earth by water again. Now, he sets that rainbow in the sky after rain as a promise that he's not going to use that method to destroy the earth. And so what do the gay people do? Well, they conscript that rainbow and they make it their own thing and they shake their fist at the Lord and they defy him by saying, "You have said you won't destroy us." But they leave out the part that says, "You won't destroy us by water." You see, I've had some of those articles of their defiance in Beast Watch News with the rainbow cloud and all the rainbow stuff they do, and they seem to not understand that the Lord will destroy them. The Lord is going to get the corruption off of the earth, and if they don't repent, he's going to destroy them along with the earth. It won't be by water, but the Lord has other means of destroying the earth. But see, they defy him by taking the promise and twisting it and perverting it and shoving it in the Lord's face and in your and my face. You see, in verse 20, he says, and Noah began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard. So he was a gardener, and he planted a vineyard, and he got some grapes, and he made wine out of it, and he got drunk. And you know, there's nothing wrong with being drunk. You do know that, right? Just don't want to become a drunkard. And it says that he was in his tent, and he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father. Now, this is very shadowy. Nobody really knows what happens here. But remember that this culture, the Bible is written in a culture of honor and shame. Honoring acts and shameful acts. And, you know, what was Ham doing in Noah's tent to begin with? That, you know, it's a shame for a grown son to be going into his father's tent and possibly seeing the nakedness of his father was not necessarily Noah's own nakedness, but possibly the nudeness or the nakedness of his mother. Because when we read about the sexual crime laws in the Torah, we read about not uncovering the nakedness of this person or the nakedness of that person. And we know that it's referring to the wife of somebody in some of those cases. So it's possible that really what Ham was looking at was his own naked mother, which is a shameful thing to do I've also heard it said that Ham had sexual relations with his own mother, and that's what that is, a euphemism right there for the shame that Ham did with his own mother. And this is not unknown in our world. I mean, following that, we have Ham is, of course, the grandfather of Nimrod. Semiramis was Nimrod's mother. Ham is the father of Cush, and Cush is the father of Nimrod. So Semiramis was married to Cush. She gave birth to Nimrod, but she became Nimrod's lover. You see, and so we have this kind of activity that just looks like it got passed down from Father Ham right on down to his grandson, Nimrod. And it says that Shem and Japheth, or Japheth, took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders and went backwards and covered whatever that, you know, nakedness was, their father, their mother, their father and their mother. Anyway, it was Shem here, you see, that took the initiative to do that, to do the honorable thing. This is why Shem is given first place in the list. When you see the genealogy of Noah, says Noah's sons are Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And yet Ham is, he's the middle son, but he is the most perverse son. But you'll notice here in verse 24 that Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. You see, Ham being called the younger son is actually a put down. It's patronizing him. It's saying that he is less than he should be. And so we have all of this kind of genealogical play back and forth. But it turns out that the righteous son, Shem, comes out on top. And in the end, that's the message, isn't it? Righteousness will always triumph. And it says in verse 27, God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. You know, when you want to curse a person, you can do two things. You can either curse the person, or you can curse their line and their progeny forever. Cursing Canaan is the way that the Lord cursed the line of Ham forever. Because if Noah had just cursed Ham, then the curse would have ended when Ham died. But the curse was so, the sin was so grave that the curse needed to be on the whole line, all the descendants of Ham through Canaan. Now, I'm going to jump over, and I want to spend some time looking at this one verse. It's Genesis 11:31. It says, and Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. Well, you know, Laura asked me about this verse, and she was asking me, you know, what I thought about that, and immediately what I saw was that, first of all, we believe that it was Abraham who was called out of Ur. Actually, it was Terah. And Terah went all the way to Haran, which is just about halfway there. And we're going to read here the next few Torah portions about people who went back and forth from the land of Canaan to Haran, you know, the members of the family that stayed in Haran. Abraham moves on from Haran. But the principle is this, the pattern is this, that the Lord called out the generation. There's two generations here. There's an older generation and the children, right? Abram and Lot, the son of Haran. And we'll read further on in the Torah where there was a generation who had some children, and they were supposed to go take the land, but they didn't want to. They failed that test. Well, here, Terah, he was called out of Ur of Chaldees, and, you know, he stopped in Haran. He didn't go and take the land of Canaan either, you see. So we have this hint. Is it definitely that this is the way it is? No. This is what I see in it. I see that, you know, we have a pattern starting that will be followed by the children of Israel, who are the descendants of Terah. So Terah lays out this foundation of only going so far with the Lord. And then we get in the wilderness and we have a generation who only goes so far with the Lord, and they die in the place where they stop. The children of Israel died in the wilderness. Terah died where he moved to Haran, where he dwelt there. And so there's a principle here that I believe is important for us, because human beings do continue to do what their ancestors did. In the end of days, we're to come out of Babylon and not fail to continue with the Lord like Terah did and like that generation in the wilderness did. We have to pass this test. You know, in I believe it's 1 Corinthians. Let's turn over there to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and look at that for just a minute, because it says in verse 6 that these things were examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things or do what the previous generations did, that we should not become idolaters, we should not commit fornication, and we should not be like those that were tempted and destroyed by the serpents in the wilderness and those that murmured in the wilderness. It says in verse 11, now all these things happened to them for examples to us, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. In other words, our forefathers, Terah and Abraham, Moses and that first generation that failed in the wilderness, Jeroboam, Rehoboam, you know, with all their failures that they had with each other and so forth, those failures are to be overcome by us. We are not to get caught in those sins and fail those tests. They're examples for us. And so this here just kind of struck me. I hadn't seen it before, that it was actually Terah with Abraham and with Lot that came out of Babylon, that came out of Ur of Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan, but they came to Haran and stayed there. They just got planted there and they didn't go any further. They failed the test. Folks, let's come out of Babylon and let us not fail the test. Let us bring our families by being obedient. We come to prepare the way for our families to be able to follow and come into the protection, into the ark, into the safe places of the wilderness, like the Lord took Noah and his family, but you'll realize that the Lord said, Noah, do this, and then the Lord put his family with Noah, right? So you have to actually do the thing. You have to actually leave Babylon. You have to actually go into the ark or into the hiding places. And then the Lord brings your family with you. You see? That's the principle. Well, I hope that this Torah portion has been a blessing to you.